Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today, October 1st, for the TRI Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum. Thank you very much for joining us. Again, we all know that we're prying you away from your desk coming the tax deadline here on October 15th, but we're glad you can join us today. Let's go ahead and get started. As a reminder, this Tax Resolution Institute Practitioners Forum occurs every first Tuesday of the month. Our next forum is going to be on November 5th, so please mark your calendar. November 5th is our next practitioners forum. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone how these calls typically work. If you can hear the sound of my voice, then that means you've logged in correctly. Because it can be difficult to moderate all the participants we have on today, we ask for questions to be submitted via email, and a lot of you responded. After we answer those questions and time permitting, we will open it up to the rest of you on the line. And as another friendly reminder, as I remind you every single Tuesday, first Tuesday of the month, VIP members have priority on these calls. So the first series of questions that we're going to be answering here are coming directly from VIP members. Thank you all for those who are members and submitted your questions ahead of time. Okay, after we get done with those questions that people have submitted, via the emails, I'm going to go ahead and announce when a Q&A session has begun, usually 20 to 15 minutes prior to the end of the call. You can feel free to type in your question or simply indicate that you want to come on live, and I'll bring you on, turn on the speakers, and let the everyone that's on hear you. Okay, now that I got that out of the way, let's go ahead and begin. Joining us on the call today, we have the head of our legal department at the Tax Resolution Institute, Mr. Norman Christman. Norman is an expert on Chapter 7, 11, and 13, debtor and creditor representation, while specializing in the discharging of federal and state taxes. Norman received his BS at the Arizona State University and received his JD at Loyola Law School. Norman has represented both debtors and creditors, has a history of successful execution, and helps to identify and clarify legal issues for his clients. A seminar speaker on discharging taxes in bankruptcy, he has been admitted to practice before the U.S. Tax Court and Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. As a leader of the Tax Resolution Institute legal team, Norman is an invaluable resource both for his ability to communicate effectively with clients and his extensive experience working with the IRS and state taxation agencies. Ladies and gentlemen, Norman Christman.
Good morning, everybody. Be sure to check out TRI's Tax Tuesdays. Remember, on the first Tuesday of each month, like today, it's Practitioner Call. As you know, it's a great opportunity to have your tax resolution questions answered at no cost to you. Every other Tuesday of this month, we have a free webinar on different tax resolution topics. Keep an eye out for our invitations via email for details. If you forget when this happens, check out our course calendar at www.taxresolutioninstitute.org/courses. And remember, we're here to teach you how to make more money, work with you on your tax resolution cases, and become your trusted referral source.
Thank you very much, Norman. And we do appreciate everyone that joined us on today's event. Of course, considering that the October 15th deadline is right around the corner, we're going to go ahead and take this opportunity to teach you a little bit more about resolution. So let's go ahead and jump to these questions. As a reminder, or as I indicated before, VIP members get priority, so the first series of questions here are coming directly from VIP members. And I will also share with you how to become a VIP member in a few, give you some of the details. So, all right, Norman, let's take the first one. This is coming from Jason. Jason is a CPA, and he is asking, a client came to me stating that her previous representative did not properly handle her IRS matters. Her sole practitioner practice was audited in 2016 for tax year 2014. Shortly after the audit began, she filed for bankruptcy. The IRS performed a quick assessment and disallowed all of her Schedule C expenses. Her representative may have not submitted a substantiation, and now she wants to reopen her audit. Based on documentation received, it looks like tax court was petitioned and a ruling came down assessing her liability of over $900,000. Can we do an OIC, Dallas to liability? This is a large liability and will be detrimental to my client.
So there's kind of more questions than answers, but the short answer is you can't submit an offer, doubt as to liability, after tax court decision. It doesn't say here whether the decision was based on a trial or what's called a stipulated decision, where the parties agree, and stipulated decisions occur probably 95% of the time. Very few tax court cases actually go to trial. So based on the odds, let's just say this was a stipulated decision, which means that the taxpayer agreed to the assessment. So they can't come back later and submit an offer and say that they didn't get the liability right. So that's not an option. I guess they could submit an offer doubt as to collectability if their finances won't allow them to pay the debt. Otherwise, they could enter into an installment agreement depending on their resources, either a partial pay or a full pay installment agreement. So it does, they do owe it. It does have to be paid, and offer doubt as to liability is not an option.
All right, Norman, thank you very much for that. This definitely seems like it's a long and complicated matter. Jason, if you have any further questions, use some of that consultation time to give us a call and see how we can help you. Moving on to Ramon. Ramon is also asking, is also a member, I should say, and is asking, assuming the three-year refund statute has passed, when filing an amendment and is approved by the IRS, will the taxpayer receive the increased refund? Or, based on the original return, if there was a tax liability that was paid in full the year the taxpayer filed, but now because of the amendment, the taxpayer no longer owes, will the IRS refund the amount paid? And he has another question here, but I'll ask that after you answer this one.
Okay. Well, if the three-year statute is passed, wouldn't it also be too late to file an amended return? And the amended return takes the place of the original return. They're not compared. So if there was a refund in one and a liability in the other, the refund doesn't offset the liability. So basically it would be whatever the amended return stated. But it seems to me if it's too late to receive the refund, it would be too late to file the amended return.
Agreed. And the next question that Ramon has here is, once a tax lien has been filed, when can the taxpayer have it removed?
So the short answer is when the tax is paid. And unless there's other circumstances, but it's not removed. It's withdrawn under certain circumstances. But in order to have it, I mean, you're using the word removed, but I think, what's the other word?
Released.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. So the thing is, a tax lien is released when the tax is paid. So that's the only grounds to release a lien. There are some equitable terms that may get a lien withdrawn, but that's a different issue. But if you're talking about getting it released, it has to be paid.
What are the, Norman, what are the programs that allow you to, I think it's a streamline that will release a lien after a certain period of liabilities under a certain amount,
yeah,
and payments are made?
So, well, no, see the way, yeah, so if there's a lien and you set up a direct debit installment agreement and you have a history of 3 months in a row where the direct debit has occurred and you owe, I think it's under $25,000, they'll release the lien or withdraw it, and there's a form that we just did one and we got it approved and the lien was withdrawn. If you enter into a direct debit installment agreement and you owe under 50 and no lien has been filed, they won't file a lien. So the thresholds are a little different between the IRS not filing a lien if a lien hasn't been filed already and withdrawing a lien if a lien has already been filed.
All right, Ramon, there you go. And let us know if you have any further questions on that.
Which is a good reason why you should enter into a direct debit installment agreement as early as possible. So you can, if you can do it before the lien has been filed, then the lien won't even be filed.
Right. Okay, next question here is coming from Steve. Steve's an EA, and he has provided a little bit of background here for this question, Norman, so let me get to that first. I have a self-employed Schedule C contractor who owes around $12,000 for 16 and just recently paper filed his 2017 and 18 1040s. With the accrued penalties and interest, he should owe about $42,000 for all the 3 years once the 17 and 18 returns are assessed. He has not made any quarterly estimated payments in 2019. The 2017 1040 was paper filed on September 1st, and the 2018 1040 was filed October 1st, which is today, actually. Both 17 and 18 were mailed USPS certified with tracking. I plan on calling ECS, who already granted us a deadline of October 5th to file the 2018 1040, on the basis that we're trying to lump all 3 years, 16, 17, and 18, together for a payment plan. My question is, given the fact that the taxpayer is already out of compliance by not making his 2019 estimated tax payments, what is the best strategy to get the IRS to drag the request for payment plan out past January 1st, 2020, avoiding having to make up the missed 2019 estimated payments and thereby including the 19 balance due with the 16, 17, and 18 balances? Total of all 4 years balances due will likely be in the close to $55,000, but the taxpayer could pay that sum down below 50 if needed. Is he still eligible for a streamlined installment agreement if he owes $49,000 for all 4 years?
Okay, so someone's too clever for their own good, and I'll tell you why. Because first of all, I don't know why January 1st is a magic date for two reasons. First of all, the fourth and final estimated payment for 2019 is due January 15th, 2020. So if you did something on January 1st, the final installment payment is still not due. So I don't know what the advantage of waiting till January 1st is. Secondly, if you want to include 2019, I would say that you need to wait until after the 2019 return is filed, and you don't have to wait until April 15th. My suggestion would be to file the 2019 return as early as possible, you know, maybe. What date last year did they start accepting returns? Was it like February 1st? Or
it was either late January or early February.
Yeah.
Right?
So you want to see when the earliest date is that the IRS is accepting 2019 returns and file it then. The other thing is, and if you want proof that it's been filed, you either want to take it down to the IRS office with a copy and have them stamp the copy received, or you want to mail it in certified so that you have a tracking number so you can track it and show that it's been received. There's a thing called a pre-assessment installment agreement. And what that means is, so 2019 either hasn't been filed yet, or it's been filed but it hasn't been processed yet. And so so when you set up the installment agreement for 16, 17, and 18, you say you'd like to put 19 in with the installment agreement, And they can do that. It's called pre-assessment. But our experience has been it never works. It never works. And so what happens is when 19 posts, it breaches the installment agreement and it throws them out of the installment agreement. I can't remember if very rarely, if ever, as the pre-assessment installment agreement works smoothly, where when the new assessment posted, it just got folded into the installment agreement without any hassle. They always get notices that they're in default and that the installment agreement is going to be terminated. The other thing is that by not making his estimated payments, they're increasing their disposable income so that if they need to do financials, it's going to appear as if they have more disposable income than they really do because they're not getting credit for estimated payments. Also, if they continue doing that, they're going to get thrown out of the installment agreement in a year from now. So they really need to start making estimated payments and stop the cycle. And the first estimated payment for 2020 is on April 15th, 2020. So that's the first. If they're not going to make any estimated for 19, they need to at least start making payments on April 15th, 2020 for the 2020 returns.
Now, the invisible question here, Norman, is what to do about the collection. They've already extended the deadline.
So what I would do, and I hope the IRS isn't listening. So what I would do is I would call and I would say that the taxpayer is attempting to borrow money from friends and relatives or whatever to pay off the liability in full within 90 days. So can they put a 90-day hold on collection to give the taxpayer an opportunity to get the money and pay the tax in full? And then when the 90 days have passed and you filed your 2019 return, then you come back and say they tried to borrow it, but they couldn't. So now they want to go into a streamlined installment agreement and pay it down and pay it down below 50. And you want to apply that to the early, they're going to apply that to the earliest year and then get it below 50 and then get into a streamlined installment agreement.
Now, is 90 days the most they'll give you or they give you more?
You know, it depends on your history. Sometimes they give as little as 30. Sometimes they won't at all. I don't remember if it's ever been more than 120. Would I say 90?
90, yeah. I think we've tried 120 before.
And has it worked?
I think it's worked.
Yeah. All right. So, try 120 and see what they say.
Yeah. It's more of a negotiating tactic at that point.
Right. But the point is that you're asking for a hold on collection to allow the taxpayer to come up with borrowing the money to pay it in full.
Right. Exactly. That's the key word there, payment in full. All right, Steve, hopefully that helped you there. Give us a call if you have any further questions and use some of that consultation time. Moving on, Norman, to the next question. Here's from Melissa, also a member. Client just had some taxes survive his personal bankruptcy because they are recent years, 16 and 17. And I want to submit an offer for him. The surviving taxes are about $25,000, but he discharged about $60,000. Through the bankruptcy, he proved his insolvency. Will the IRS expedite the offer because of this? Anything I should look out for?
Yeah, so the bankruptcy has nothing to do with qualifying for an offer. And there are several definitions of insolvency. And one definition of insolvency that the bankruptcy court uses is if the debtor's liabilities exceed his assets. But that may be true before bankruptcy and not true after bankruptcy, because if he filed, let's say, a Chapter 7 and it was a no-asset case, which meant that all his assets were protected and that there was no liquidation of his assets and distribution to unsecured creditors because he had no non-exempt property. Well, then he discharged, like you said, $60,000 in taxes, and who knows what else he discharged, credit card debt, medical bills, you know, whatever. So the point is that after bankruptcy, he may no longer be insolvent because his liabilities may not exceed his assets anymore. So you really can't go by that. The offer would just, again, be his income and expenses, and his expenses may be less now because certain debt may have been discharged. Also, even if assets were exempt and not liquidated by the trustee, the value of the assets, the equity, may still be used to determine the amount that the IRS will accept as an offer. So you're really starting from scratch. It's just, if the purpose of the bankruptcy was to just discharge taxes and then file an offer for the balance, you could have just done the same thing by filing the offer without the bankruptcy. Unless there are other grounds for filing the bankruptcy, it really didn't help the offer at all. Remember, an offer is based on ability to pay, not on as much as you owe. So the fact that he discharged the $60,000 doesn't really help or hurt the offer.
All right, Melissa. Moving on to Jessica here, Norman. Jessica's asking, how long after the statute of limitations expire on collection can the IRS collect from a lien? Can you force the IRS to cancel a lien after the statute of limitation expires on collections, or at their discretion, can they keep the lien until the property is sold?
So the purpose of an IRS lien is to protect the taxpayer's assets for IRS collection purposes. But once the collection statute is expired and the IRS can no longer collect the tax, then there's no purpose of the lien. And so the lien is released automatically after the 10-year statute has expired. It's called a face release because it's on the face of the notice of federal tax lien that's recorded that says that this federal tax lien is automatically released on such and such a date unless the IRS renews it. And the only ground for the IRS to renew the lien is if there was a stay and the collection statute had tolled. And so now the IRS gets to extend the lien until the statute expires. And so it may be longer because if the statute was tolled, let's say, for instance, in a bankruptcy or a pending offer a pending installment agreement, or the taxpayers were out of the country for more than 6 months. So there are things that's told the statute on collection. And when the statute of collection is told, then the IRS gets to extend the lien for the amount of time that the statute is extended. But once the statute expires, the lien has to be released.
All right, Norman, thank you very much. And on to our last VIP member question here from Craig. Craig is asking a similar question to Melissa, Norman. He's asking, working in an OIC for a client who's currently in CNC, will this help or hurt them, or what are the advantages?
Yeah, so if a client is currently not collectible, then that means that his expenses either exceed his income or is equal to, so there's no disposable income, because an IRS will enter into an installment agreement for as little as $25 a month. So to put a taxpayer into currently non-collectible, it means that the taxpayer doesn't even have $25 a month disposable income to pledge into an installment agreement. So that would, if his circumstance is the same, then that should help when you complete the 433A OIC for the offer, because an offer is based on two calculations. One is the taxpayer's disposable income multiplied by a certain number of months, and that number varies, and the value of their assets, the equity in their assets. So even if the taxpayer is non-collectible because they don't have disposable income, they still may have equity in their home or other equity that would be used to determine the amount that the IRS will accept in an offer. But having no disposable income is a good thing for offer purposes, but it's not the final analysis.
Right. All right, guys, that's it for the VIP membership questions. And just take a quick moment here. If you're interested in getting all your questions answered or using some consultation time to dive in deeper into any particular matter that you have or coming across, become a VIP member. What the VIP membership, what we offer is 3 hours of consultation. You get free access to our videos on demand, which basically means all our courses that are available online, you can view them at no additional cost. You get access to a comprehensive library, including forms that are very often used in all resolution matters. You get e-learning courses. So if you want to be able to test your knowledge and make sure that you have a thorough understanding of all resolution matters, look at our e-learning courses that will help you with that. You also get discounts on everything else on our website. I'm going to go ahead and push a link now to go ahead and try us out for a 2-month free trial. So for those of you who are interested in signing up, we are going to let you try it out for free for 2 months at no cost to you. So I'm pushing the link now, and let's go on, Norman, to the remaining questions here. So this is coming from David. David is a CPA, and he's asking, in other conference calls, I've heard you talking about pyramiding tax debt. I have one individual client that gets a $12,000 K-1 from a 1065. He has not been paying as you go, so I did an installment agreement for him for 2018. But he will be in the same situation in 2019, probably having about $14,000 in K-1 income. I assume I'll be trying another installment agreement for 19. I don't see this behavior changing anytime soon. So what are the chances the IRS will work with us in 2019 and going forward?
So what's going to happen is, I don't know if the installment agreement was a streamline. I'm going to assume that, and it doesn't say how much he owes, only what his K-1 income is. And it doesn't say whether or not that's the only tax that he owes on the return. Whether, you know, so I don't know that. But the thing is, when he files his 19 return and there's a balance due, then it's going to terminate his installment agreement. And so you have to renegotiate a new one. If it's a streamline, then his monthly payment may double because his tax liability may double if he's going to owe the same in 2019 as he owed in 2018, or in this case, maybe even a little bit more. So number one is, if you're going to do a streamline, be prepared to possibly double the monthly installment payment. And if it's not a streamline and it's based on a 433F, then the the problem is that they're going to show disposable income that's really an excess of what his true disposable income is, because they're not going to give him credit for making estimated payments because he's not making them. And so his monthly payment based on a 433F is going to be higher than it should be. So, I mean, the solution is he does need to make estimated payments. What this doesn't say is, does he get the money monthly, or is a year kind of a year-end bonus kind of thing or whatever? But he should be making, whenever he gets a distribution, he should be putting away 20% or something, sending it to the IRS for estimated payments so that he doesn't owe again. But this is going to be a problem. I mean, the IRS will work with you, but it's going to cost you more and more every year.
So David just chimed in and responded saying that the liability was only $2,000 and it was a streamlined. So the issue is he's going to continue to add $2,000 liability.
Right. So if he adds another $2,000 liability and his monthly payments is based on liability over a certain number of months, then it's going to double. So just be prepared when you call in to, but the thing is, Streamline is not eligible for taxpayers who've had a installment agreement terminated within a year. So the thing is, they are filing the return and owing may terminate his installment agreement, in which case he may not be eligible for another streamline.
So the idea here, David, is us as their representatives sometimes have to have these hard conversations with the taxpayers, letting them know that they cannot continue the behavior that they had in the past. The IRS will be accommodating, will be flexible for maybe once, twice, but at a certain point, it's just going to get worse for the taxpayer, and the IRS is going to stop honoring their installment agreements and force collection on him.
I mean, he should be making like $500 a quarter estimated payment. So, I mean, that's, what is that, $150 a month?
Yeah. A little over.
Yeah, you should just do it.
Right. All right, David, let us know if you need any help. Consider signing up for a membership, and we can help you using some of that consultation time. Next question here is from Margaret. Margaret is asking, IRS accepted my client's OIC for tax year 2018. When we originally filed the return, there was an overpayment, which I understand the IRS keeps. If you file an amended return and now have a balance due, will the IRS give you credit for the overpayment you had reported on the original return?
This really doesn't make sense to me, because if the offer was for tax year 2018, but the original return showed an overpayment, what would the offer be for?
Right. We're assuming, Margaret, that he had a liability prior to 2018?
And they kept the 2018
refund?
Refund.
Yeah.
Which they would do in an offer. And now he's going to amend a return and he's going to owe.
Right.
Would he get credit for the overpayment? I mean, if you look at the transcript, it's going to actually work against him, because that's a refund that he shouldn't have gotten, plus the amount that he owes on the amended return. So I'm sorry, but I don't understand why an offer would be submitted for a tax year with a refund.
Right. So do us a favor, Margaret, and chime in here in the questions box or the chat box, and we'll come back to you. Moving on to Thomas. Thomas is saying, greetings. If you detect from a transcript that an audit is scheduled for your client sometime in the future, keep in mind that sometimes such audits don't materialize. Are your voluntary disclosure options eliminated, or still try the pre-clearance procedure and put it up to the IRS? Thanks.
So I'm not sure what you're asking. It seems like what you're saying is, should he go ahead and amend the return if he knows that some of the expenses or something are going to be disallowed, or you know he kind of overstated them. So should he amend the return prior to the audit? And I would say no, because I think amending the return prior to the audit is almost like a admission that you did something wrong. So that we would instruct taxpayers not to do that in anticipation of an audit. Let the audit go through, and then they'll allow what they're going to allow.
All right. Moving on to April. April was asking, the IRS filed SFRs for my client about 4 years ago. He has been paying through an installment agreement. Client just lost his job and is losing his home. Unsecured creditors are coming after him, and he can no longer afford the installment payments. He will be filing for BK soon and wanted to make sure the taxes were included. Anything you can tell me to help guide me?
Yeah, find a good bankruptcy attorney who understands taxes, because most, I'm assuming it's going to be a Chapter 7 or 13, which are bankruptcies that for consumer debt, as opposed to, let's say, a Chapter 11, which is usually a business debt. So the thing is, if it's most bankruptcies are discharging consumer debt, credit cards and things like that. And your average bankruptcy attorney understands consumer debt, but doesn't understand tax debt. And so you want to find a bankruptcy attorney who understands tax debt. Just a heads up, generally speaking, and there are some exceptions depending on where the taxpayer lives and his history, SFRs, which are substitute for returns, are not dischargeable in a Chapter 7. And so if he's going to be filing a 13, he's going to be paying he's going to have to pay that tax in the Chapter 13 because it's not dischargeable. And so I'm not sure whether or not he's going to receive any tax relief in the bankruptcy. He may not. I mean, there may get some relief on credit card debt and other debt, but he may not get any relief from his tax debt. And so, again, you want to check with a bankruptcy attorney who understands tax dischargeability.
All right, moving to the next question here is from Nick. Nick is asking two questions. Client owes back taxes for 13 and 14 tax years, approximately $80,000, plus taxes for 15 and 18, about $23,000. Can I do an offer and compromise for just the past 2 years only? Get on a payment plan for 15 and 18 years? So let's tackle that one first.
Yeah, okay. Why? I mean, why? It doesn't make any sense to me what the advantage would be. Whether, first of all, I'm not sure you could do it. Secondly, I'm not sure how you would do it. I guess you'd have to do the installment agreement first, because then you'd have an expense on your 433 AOIC, but they would make you throw all the other taxes into the offer, and then you'd have all that disposable income, and so your offer would be higher. So
yeah, Nick, if you can explain your logic here. Usually when you do an offer, it's to wipe out your entire liability, not just a portion of it.
Right, because it's based on ability to pay, not how much you owe. And so I see no advantage into having some years in an offer and some years in an installment agreement. I would think you'd want to do one or the other.
All right. And then the second question is, how do you handle a situation where the IRS is sending amount due notices for a person who's passed away? They are sending them to a former spouse. The IRS knows that he has passed because they filed the deceased tax return. Do we just ignore the letters, file for CNC? How does the IRS handle balances owed for someone who's passed away?
Okay, so what it doesn't say here is are the taxes that are owed, are they also, as a former spouse, were they filed jointly with the former spouse? So there's a former spouse liable on their own. Or were these tax liabilities that were generated after the divorce? So I'd have to know that. But generally speaking, the question is, how do they collect taxes from someone passed away? And the answer is they file a claim in probate. So when someone passes away, a probate is created in state court, at least here in California, and the IRS files a claim in probate and can get, you know, assets, the deceased taxpayer's assets through probate. But as to the former spouse, I don't know what their liability is on the unpaid taxes. I also don't know if they're sending the notices to the former spouse or to the deceased spouse, care of the former spouse. We've seen that before too.
Right.
And they really don't, it's really not to the former spouse, and the former spouse is really not liable. They're just receiving notices, their care of, for the deceased spouse.
Yeah. So one of the things they need to be careful is before they go into probate or look at the estates or disperse the estate assets, is making sure that there is no liability, because the IRS could file afterwards and come after it.
Right.
Our beneficiaries.
Right. And is the former spouse involved in probate?
Right. All right. Moving on to Sharona. Sharona is asking, client is trying to qualify for a mortgage. A week before she is supposed to go to closing to purchase a home, she finds out that there were liens for unpaid tax debt that her ex-husband was supposed to pay as part of a divorce settlement. Looks like 2007 to 2014, joint debt of about $69,000. 15 to 18, individual debt about $8,200, so totals about $77,000. I was told that the balance has to be paid in full for the two liens that were filed in 9 and 11. Those balances are $26,000 combined. Does she have to pay off the entire debt for the two liens to enter into an agreement? Her assessed amount is over $50,000, so she'd have to make a voluntary payment on the $53,000 of at least $3,900 to bring it under $50,000. The IRS said that when the balance is over $50,000, they are required to file a lien and have advised that a lien will be filed for the other outstanding amounts. An installment agreement would be $1,151 per month for 79 months. This isn't realistic and would make her debt to income ratio sky high to qualify for a mortgage. In order to qualify for a mortgage, does she need to take care of the state and federal, or should I focus on the federal first? I know that if I take care of the state, then the installment payment can be included in debt for the IRS financial statement. Where do I start is her question.
Yeah, good question. Well, I'll tell you where I would start is she should go to her divorce attorney and get on the ex's case, because he's supposed to pay the tax and didn't. And so now it's negatively affecting her ability to buy a house. So I think the first thing to do would be to go back into divorce court and get the court to order him to pay the taxes that he's liable for.
Now, Sharonda, what's happening here is the IRS isn't going to care what the civil court decided.
Right, because whatever the arrangement in the divorce of who will pay the tax. It's not binding on the IRS. The IRS just wants to get paid. And if both former spouses are liable on the tax, they can go after either one regardless of any settlement or order or any disposition in the divorce court. So when you say where to start, I would start with the ex-husband. Also, it doesn't say here, but it'd be interesting to know if she's buying a house in the same county where the tax liens are filed, because those liens are recorded in the county recorder and only attach to real property in that county. And so maybe if she bought something in another county, there would be no liens for that county. Also, usually, if when the lien is recorded, there's no real property. If the taxpayer acquires real property afterwards, it's called money purchase, and the IRS will subordinate its lien to the mortgage holder. And so the taxpayer can still get a mortgage even though there was an IRS lien that pre-existed it, but it will actually, the mortgage will actually get first priority over the tax lien. And that's something that's automatic. So that may be an answer too.
All right. Guys, just so I update everybody, we have about a little over 10 minutes left on this forum. We're going to go ahead and be opening it up to those of you who are on the line. A few of you have already responded and submitted some questions, so we'll try to get to those. I do want to take a quick minute here and invite everyone to our upcoming event on November 14th. November 14th is our full day, 8-hour Tax Resolution Institute event. What we do this maybe once or twice a year, and what the purpose of this course is to, you're going to learn how to make your most difficult clients your highest source of income, learn how to easily perform the work that you dread the most, and learn the tips and traps you need to make you a tax resolution expert. So the event is happening on November 14th. We're doing it in two ways, a live seminar so you can attend in person if you're local, or some of you do fly in, or you can attend via our webcast. It starts at 8 o'clock Pacific Standard and 11 Eastern. So mark your calendars for that. If you can't make the live event, we will be rebroadcasting the event on two additional dates. But what we'll do then is break it up into four-hour segments, November 19th and 20th. I'm going to push a link now if you want to read more about it. And also for those of you who are attending today, special promotion for those on the line is 25% off. So you're going to use a promo code, which I am sending in the chat box now. If you want to register for the event and take advantage of that promo code, check the chat box. I'm going to be sending that here shortly. All right, Norman, let's get to the rest of these questions. Angelina is asking, to what extent does the IRS enforce collection? In other words, would the IRS make you sell your home that has a lot of equity before putting you into non-collectible status? What about other assets, cars, collectibles, et cetera?
Yeah, generally speaking, no, they're not looking to take your home away from you. But they are, even if you had no disposable income, and so you didn't qualify for an installment agreement, they would still want you to try to get a home equity loan. So if you had a lot of equity in your home before even requesting an installment agreement or currently not collectible status or whatever, the taxpayer should apply for a home equity line of credit. And if they're denied, which in this case we want them to be, they should have that denial letter ready. And when you call ACS to set up an installment agreement or currently non-collectible or whatever, and the equity in the home becomes an issue, then you present them with a copy of the letter denying their home equity line of credit application. And that would be that. And so we've had cases where we had a case where a taxpayer owed $60,000 to the IRS, but had $600,000 of equity in their home. And based on a letter that they applied for a home equity line of credit and was denied, and so that $600,000 in equity wasn't available to them, we got a very small installment agreement, something like $50 a month or something. So, because it was only based on their disposable income, because the letter denying the home equity line of credit showed that the equity was not accessible to them. And so it was like they didn't have it.
All right. Thank you very much. Hopefully that helps you there, Angelina. Moving on to Jessica. Norman, Jessica's online, and she's asking, for an OIC based on data to collectability, agent is looking to client's ability to pay for the offer amount rather than the issues raised regarding the liability, which was an audit gone bad a while back. So question one, how much weight does disposable income have on the OIC versus the issue of data to liability?
Doubt is the liability. It doesn't even look at your disposable income, right, if that's what you're asking.
No, so, what she's asking is the liability was assessed because of an audit, and she's doing...
Which offer should she submit?
No, she's submitting an offer data to collectability.
Okay.
She's wondering whether one issue has impact on the other.
No, so if you're doing an offer data to liability, then disposable income isn't an issue. I don't even think you need to do a 433 AOIC on a doubt as the liability offer. You do a different, as a different, instead of the 656, which is the offer for doubt as to collectability, you do a 656L.
Right.
Which is the form for doubt as to liability. And it's a completely different form, and it goes through a completely different thing. You just have to agree that you owe something, and that you make, and that you agree to that you're going to owe X amount, and you might want to submit, you would submit with the doubt as to liability why you don't owe it, like if it was an audit and expenses were disallowed because you didn't have proof, so you would submit proof.
But Jessica's question is, she's submitting doubt as to collectability.
Okay. So if you're submitting doubt as to collectability, then liability isn't an issue. Right. You're just acknowledging that you owe it, but that you can't pay it. You can't do both. And so you're either saying, you're either submitting an offer because you admit that you owe it, but you can't pay it. Or the other way would be you admit that you may be able to pay it, but you don't agree that you owe it.
Right. And so her question is, how much weight does disposable income have? Then the answer is entirely.
On a doubt as to liability?
Doubt as to collectability. Yes.
Right. It's based on your disposable income multiplied by a certain factor plus the equity that you have in your home, car,
life insurance,
all that kind of stuff.
Her second question is, agent is imputing income from separated husband who is not liable for the tax debt because client does not work and husband is covering bills as support, but that covers only living expenses. How difficult is it to dispute disposable income in such a situation? We've had this many times.
Yeah, so if they're divorced, then that income is separate income. So they shouldn't be taking in his considering his income and expenses. It doesn't say what state they're in. So, for instance, in a community property state, once you file for a divorce, the community property is broken and it becomes separate property. I think you could do, they would look at your bank statement, let's say, and see how much does he put in your bank every month. That would be considered income. But the question is, does it vary or is it based on a court order? So is there some court order in the divorce court that for spousal support? Or is it just he just gives you whatever he wants? I don't get it.
All right. Well, you do have those situations, Jessica. So consider signing up for a membership if you want us to dive into it a little bit deeper. Noel is asking, when the IRS files an SFR and assesses a tax due, does the statute of limitations still apply? If so, would it be better to allow the statute to expire?
Yeah. So the statute on collection is 10 years from the date of assessment. So on an SFR, it would be 10 years from the date that the SFR was assessed. And yeah, that would be uncollectible after 10 years.
The biggest issue with SFRs are bankruptcy, whether or not you can discharge in bankruptcy.
Yeah, you can also, and because it's an SFR, and an SFR could be assessed years after the due date of the return, so that if a return had been filed timely, the assessment would have run. The collection statute would have expired, but now the collection statute has kind of expanded. And so you could be still collectible years after the due date of the return.
So on that same topic, Daniel is asking, can you file a tax return after an SFR is prepared? Should it be an amended return?
No, it's an original return.
It's an original return, correct. But yes, you definitely can file a return after an SFR. Usually you want to do that because you want to include any deductions or expenses that the IRS doesn't know.
It may or may not have effect on bankruptcy, though.
All right, let's see here. Moving on to Carrie. Looks like, Carrie, you're going to be the last one here. A new client came to my firm with over 10 years of unfiled years. At first glance, it looks like he will owe something every year. The IRS has not assessed him in any liability as of yet, although I have sent notices asking him to file his delinquent returns. Do we have to file all the years that are unfiled? Any guidance provided will help.
Okay, I'd say yes, because I couldn't see suggesting that a taxpayer not file their returns. Unless there was a year that they didn't have any income, or they didn't have significant income to enough to what's called a filing requirement. So there might have been some years where there was no filing requirement, and so you're not obligated to file returns where there's no requirement to file them. But you may want to file them anyways. Sometimes we file returns that are called zero returns that show that the taxpayer had zero income, just so the IRS knows that they didn't forget to file a return. So what you want to do is you want to order wage and income transcripts for all the years. I think you can, doesn't it go back 10 years?
Yeah.
So you can get wage and income transcripts, and then you could see and some, based on the wage and income transcripts, some years may not have filing requirement. And so the IRS is even looking for returns for those years. They're only looking for returns for the years where the wage and income transcripts shows sufficient income to require a return.
All right. I don't have time for another one, so I'm going to go ahead and conclude here. Thank you, everyone, for those of you who submitted your questions ahead of time and those of you who requested them online. If we did not get to your question, I'm going to add them to our bank and make sure that we ask them next month. So join us next Monday, November 5th, is the next Tax Resolutions to Practitioners Forum. I also pushed in our chat box a couple of the promotions, including the 2-month free trial of our VIP membership and a 25% discount for our upcoming event coming up on November 14th. I'm going to leave those up for a few minutes after the event, so please take advantage of those. And again, thank you all for attending, and we look forward to seeing you soon. Have a great day, everyone.